From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the sixth day of October 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. A bit later in the program, Matt Bennett will join us from Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds in his farm there in Windsor, Illinois. And as we close out the time together, we'll discuss the weather forecast with Mike Tenora, T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, Illinois. As you're making your way through this harvest season, you're probably watching with a little disgust, I would think, some of the weeds that have been showing up in both your corn and your soybean fields. There's some new research happening here on this campus with a piece of equipment called the Harrington Seed Destructor. It's a mechanical way to control the seeds as they come out of the back end of your combine. We'll hear more about that too today on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, December corn futures finished 7.25 cents lower at 340.5 today. The March at 350.25, also down 7.25. November beans up 1.75 cents at 950.5. The January at 964.75, 1.25 cents higher. Bean oil up 44 cents. Bean meal down $2.30. December soft red winter wheat down 9.25. The July harvest month 8 cents lower at 442.75. And July hard red at 442.75. Down a dime for the day. Live cattle futures down 70 cents at 102.15. October feeders at 127.35 were a dime lower, and October lean hogs for the day at $50.27.5, up $2.05. We're now joined by Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas, to take a look at the marketplace. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
Well, I was thinking that when I talked to you this week, we might be talking a little bit more giddy up than we really are, I guess. Although you're the technician and I'm not, corn futures were lower for the day.
Yeah, it looks like there's a combination of things. I think probably maybe what maybe helped tip the scale is, number one, corn had reached some overbought levels looking at some of these technical indicators. And then when you had the FC Stone and the FOMA economics production numbers coming out, still pushing that upper end yield estimate, and then adding additional acres to the report, came out with some pretty hefty numbers. So I think those two reports plus an overbought technical condition just pretty well had corn kind of give up the ship. We had a move right up almost to the 350 level. Couldn't get the follow through that we needed after Monday's strong up on the market. And I think what you saw then was just a lot of long liquidation. There had been a tendency for a lot of traders to be long two or three units of corn, maybe short one unit of soybeans. Based upon the idea that the corn yield or production numbers on corn were probably coming down, and the production number on soybeans was going up based upon the yield reports that we've been hearing for beans. So I think you saw some of that take hold, some liquidation of that long corn short soybean spread, and that helped soybeans come off their lows and close kind of unchanged, slightly higher, but corn and wheat took it pretty well on the chin to the downside. But a lot of it, I think, is it's still harvest. We've got fairly active harvesting going on. There's no doubt about it. We're harvesting a big crop. We don't necessarily know how big that crop is, but it is big. And the dollar was fairly strong here today. Even though we did have good exports, anytime you get a strong dollar, that has a tendency to damper commodity prices, especially agriculture commodities at this time of year.
What formations do we have, and what have been violated in either the corn and soybean market from the technical side for the charts?
Well, on the technical side, I've been looking at this head and shoulder bottom formation that's kind of shows up on the December corn futures. Monday, we posted a real strong close above the neckline, and then we held those closes both on Tuesday and Wednesday. Now, today, depending on how tightly you want to draw the trend line, we came right back down to it or closed maybe slightly below it. It's not uncommon for a market to break out of a formation and then fall back to the point of breakout and then consolidate for a few days. And then if the breakout's valid, then it would go back in the direction of the breakout. If it was a false breakout, then we would, you know, continue to fall back into the trading range that we've been basically trading in. And corn's been kind of in this 325 to, you know, 345 trading range. We're at 340 here on the close. So I don't see anything significantly technical damage done. I think a lot of it will probably be, you know, how we finish up the week. And more importantly, what USDA tells us next week. You know, both FC Stone and Informa Economics are using the FSA numbers, which do imply that we could be harvesting, you know, a half a million to a million acres or more corn than what USDA is using on the balance sheet. But I also know that there's a lot of people that don't necessarily think that's going to happen. So if it doesn't happen and USDA keeps the acreage kind of unchanged, then probably the report would be turned, would be somewhat friendly. I think it's hard to get anything bullish out of anything these days, at least for right now, but it would be friendly based upon expectations because I think those two groups have kind of got the trade braced for larger acres and a fairly sizable production number. We'll just have to kind of go from there. That'll be the key. November reports usually don't have much impact, and then we kind of wait around for the January final to kind of shore things up. So this October report's probably one of the most important reports that we'll see because that gives us USDA will have better data for yield estimates. And then this is always the report that they do tinker a little bit with acreage. And, you know, like I said, Informa and FC Stone both believe that there's going to be a significant rise in harvested acres.
Hey, thanks so much. We'll talk with you again this afternoon at about 3 o'clock Central Time for the Commodity Week program and get that posted to the website tonight.
Very well.
That, of course, is Dan Zwicker. He's with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. In today's agricultural news, the U.S. Grains Council says the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership will offer an avenue for increased global trade. That message comes at a time U.S. farmers are preparing to harvest another year of bumper crops, but the good crops mean lower prices. North Carolina farmer and Grain Council board member Darren Armstrong says the best way to increase prices to increase demand through trade.
The best place for demands is access to some markets that we don't have right now, and overseas export markets are a great place to look. There's a lot of potential for growth, and favorable trade policy gets us access to those markets. And I think that's one thing that we need to keep in mind is to keep pressing for favorable trade policy and to try to grow our demand so it can keep pace with the large crops that we're growing.
He says good trade policy is vital for U.S. agriculture because of the need for trade. Armstrong says the Trans-Pacific Partnership provides a great opportunity to access new markets.
You look at countries like Vietnam, where it's an extremely fast-growing food market. Also, whether it's Vietnam or other countries that want to export things like meat or poultry or dairy, all of which, you know, is produced here in the U.S., and those products could be exported as well, which are grown using our feed products. So TPP really is a great opportunity to access some places that we might not be able to get to now, and it's just a very important part of our export program.
Armstrong says delaying approval of the trade deal harms agriculture. Armstrong, of course, is a grain farmer from North Carolina and serves on the U.S. Grains Council's board of directors. Well, let's stay on that export front but come back to the state of Illinois, where a congressman has proposed reform to the Inland Waterways Trust Fund to speed up locks and dams projects. That's caught the national attention of some groups. The Waterways Council is looking at the House provision by the Central Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis to study taking management of the trust fund away from the Army Corps of Engineers. House and Senate bills must still be reconciled. Davis wants a not-for-profit or government-owned firm to run the fund to speed long-delayed locks projects key for shipping 60% of U.S. grain through the Upper Mississippi and Illinois system. Illinois' Davis complained recently that it's been 9 years since Congress authorized construction of the seven new 1,200-foot locks along the Upper Mississippi and Illinois waterway system. Yet 9 years later, the Army Corps hasn't even done pre-construction engineering and design for the projects. Calhoun says the 2007 WERDA authorized funds that still need to be appropriated. Waterways Council Executive Vice President Deborah Calhoun.
And that's a real issue and a priority for Waterways Council. Just having $10 million in TED money for that navigation ecosystem and sustainability program that would both provide increased capacity on the Upper Midwest and Illinois waterway, and then also an equal amount of money in spending and investment for navigation ecosystem sustainability program.
But Calhoun says the administration has not prioritized the $10 million needed, so the money has not been appropriated. Without the planning phases, the Upper Mississippi and Illinois locks are still not shelf-ready. After almost 10 years, prolonging barge delays, hurting U.S. exports, and raising costs for farmers, shippers, and consumers. And finally today, this story. PETA has started a campaign to get CNN's Anderson Cooper, the moderator of Sunday's presidential debate at Washington University in St. Louis, to press Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on their views of animal agriculture and climate change. Here's the proposed question. The U.S. is set to miss its 2025 environmental targets, given that animal agriculture produces 51% of greenhouse gas emissions. Will you protect the environment by promoting a plant-based lifestyle? Now, the proposed question really could make it. For the first time, ABC and CNN will use an online voting system and consider the 30 most popular questions. As of late Wednesday night, PETA's question was the 28th most popular, with 11,964 votes. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. This morning I spent on the South Farms here in Urbana-Champaign with Adam Davis. He's a research scientist with the ARS, that's the Agricultural Research Service, that belongs to the United States Department of Agriculture. In a moment, we'll hear an interview with him about the research he's doing on the South Farms with the Harrington Seed Destructor. Essentially, this is a large toe behind the combine machine that destroys weed seeds by crushing them. He'll tell us more about that. There are only two of them in the nation, one on this campus and one in Beltsville, Maryland. Name and title first, please.
I'm Adam Davis. I'm a research ecologist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service and an associate professor in the Crop Sciences Department at University of Illinois.
Why are you at the U of I?
ARS often embeds its units within universities in order to create synergies between state scientists and federal scientists.
What's the Harrington Seed Destructor?
The Harrington Seed Destructor is a new device, relatively new, a few years old, that was created by an Australian wheat farmer named Ray Harrington in order to deal with his herbicide-resistant weeds.
So what does it do?
The Harrington Seed Destructor takes weed seeds that are captured by the combine harvester during crop harvest and puts them through a cage mill that turns them into a fine powder and kills them. And
so essentially even seeds that are really tiny like those from pick-a-weed.
Water hemp, pigweed.
And it crushes them so that they can't germinate, or at least when they fall to the ground, they're unable to germinate because they begin to decay.
Yeah, that's right. So we've already done some work with the HSD as a stationary device where we put seven different weed species into it, varying in size from really small like water hemp to really big like cocklebur, and none of them survived. We had greater than 99% destruction for all of them.
What's your hope with this?
My hope is that the HSD can take some stress off of our chemical tools, which are rapidly failing. As everybody who farms in central Illinois knows, we have serious problems with herbicide resistance here and really across the nation now in grain production systems. And a lot of that is because we've placed so much reliance on the chemical tools year in, year out, that we've developed resistance.
Are there some weeds that are infield problems, meaning they spread infield, and some that are not?
Sure. So seeds that fall from plants through gravity, like in species like pigweed or water hemp, velvet leaf, those are mostly infield problems, although they can spread long distances through grain contamination or waterfowl or things like that. But then there are other weeds like mare's tail, horseweed, and that can go very long distances through wind transport.
So this is to control things like water hemp?
Yes. Yeah, so for things that fall right near the mother plant, this is the way to control
it. Is it likely that farmers will buy one of these themselves? Can they use it, you suppose, in the future? And is there a future for it in the United States, do you think?
I think the current model, which is a toe-behind model, is pretty expensive for an individual grower to own. It's about $180,000. But there's an integrated model coming, about a fifth of that, about $30,000. That would be an aftermarket kit or bolt-on, and I think that would be within a price point that an individual grower could do.
And the work you're doing will prove whether this is worthwhile or not.
Exactly. We're looking at, this field contains an ALS-resistant population of water hemp, and we're trying to see whether using the HSD on it can prevent it from spreading and becoming enriched in ALS resistance.
That's Adam Davis from the United States Department of Agriculture's Agriculture Research Service, or ARS. He's been working with the Harrington Seed Destructor on the South Farms here at the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. There are two of these particular machines in the United States, one here on this campus, one in Beltsville, Maryland. And then the bolt-on version that he spoke of is in Arkansas this year and will be in full use next year. You can see more about the Harrington Seed Destructor maybe this afternoon, certainly by this evening, on our website at willag.org. I was in the field this morning and took some video of that piece of equipment in action. If you'd like to see more, again, visit willag.org, willag.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on a Thursday afternoon. Mike Tenor now joins us from T-Storm Weather. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Farmers in the Midwest have had a bit of rainfall, not a lot, but enough to slow them down, though I suspect they're going to have some open weather for a while. Can you tell me what we've had and what we can expect?
Well, we've seen most of the rain this week in the western third of the Corn Belt and then into adjacent areas of the plains. This area is also receiving rain today and will receive a little bit more tonight. So we've been seeing rain in the same area throughout the week, and most of that having fallen to the west of Illinois, though of course we did see some rainfall overnight. In the bigger picture though, as we go forward, we're not going to see much in the way of rainfall once we get into tomorrow. All of the rain will pretty much end across the Corn Belt tomorrow morning, and that will leave us in a dry and mild period going forward. We don't think there will be very much rain at all starting up tomorrow and then lasting 5 to 7 days across most of the central U.S. So there will be a large-scale harvesting and planting window coming up, especially in the areas that didn't see any rain this week.
Quickly, South America, what kind of conditions as they begin their growing season?
Everything there has been going fairly well. We've seen some wet periods. We've seen some dry periods. We see the rainy season beginning in the northern soybean areas of Brazil. And we look for all of this to continue with more mixed weather. And mixed weather is kind of what you would like to have right now because it is planting season for corn, soybeans, and sunflower. So a little bit of rain, a little bit of drying, and you put that together. That's a great way to start your growing season. And on top of that, the wheat in that region is also receiving a little bit of rain. Maybe a little bit more would be ideal, but all in all, it's hard to draw up too many problems in South America at the moment.
And finally, for this Thursday, we'd better check in on Hurricane Matthew.
Hurricane Matthew is a dangerous system, currently rated as a Category 4 out of 5, and winds are sustained at 140 miles an hour near the core of that system. The real problem with it, more than anything, is the path that it's expected to take. It's located currently about 150 miles to the southeast of West Palm Beach, Florida, and is moving that direction. It will eventually make landfall later tonight, either as a direct strike or an indirect strike to the north of Palm Beach by around 30 to 40 miles. After that, it moves due north along the coastline and eventually restrikes the United States somewhere around the Georgia-South Carolina border on Saturday. So we're talking about two major strikes of the same hurricane, and it will also move along a highly densely populated area, primarily along and east of Interstate 95 from Central Florida all the way into parts of South Carolina. That's not the track you would ever want to see a hurricane follow, especially one that is as strong as this. There'll be a lot of damage in that area, and it's fairly unfortunate for a lot of coastal communities, again, primarily from West Palm Beach onto the north, all the way into parts of the South Carolina area.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Mike Tenura, of course, is with T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.